Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, July 5th, 2008. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. As we continue through this July 4th weekend, it's crucial that we take time to reflect on the great legacy which was left to us as Americans by our founding fathers and to pledge ourselves to renewing the commitment they made to perfect institutions of self-government so that we may leave a worthwhile legacy to those who follow us. We've come to a moment of truth in history. For nearly 40 years, our nation has broken with the commitment of the founding fathers. Our leading institutions have been subverted, taken over by the same outlook of Anglo-Dutch liberalism that our founding fathers rebelled against. Free trade, privatization, deregulation, these components of what is called globalization are the policies of the British Empire, directed by the financial institutions of the City of London. The American Revolution was fought to free our colonies from the imperial tyranny of London. It is not just unfortunate that few Americans know this history today. It is potentially tragic. Our civilization is careening into a dark age, one consciously imposed by the same forces in London which backed the South in the Civil War in an attempt to break up the United States. The same forces responsible for the awful carnage of World War I, and the same forces which launched fascism in Europe after World War I, leading directly to the Second World War. These very same forces are behind the breakdown of the financial system today through a decades-long assault on what Franklin Roosevelt did to revive the American system, to end the Great Depression, and to defeat fascism. Once again, they're unleashing chaos on the world, which will lead to the destruction of as many as 5 billion people if they're not defeated, this time, for good. Therefore, it's entirely appropriate and urgently necessary that we recommit ourselves to defeating the British Empire this 4th of July weekend. An essential part of winning this war is knowing the enemy and mastering the method by which great American patriots in the past defeated this enemy. To that end, LaRouche PAC and the LaRouche Youth Movement have produced a brilliant documentary, 1932, which is now up on the LaRouche PAC website, to do two things at once: to inform the viewer of the facts of this ongoing struggle, and to uplift the viewer by presenting this documentary as an unfolding classical tragedy, to inspire the viewer to break the chains of popular opinion and accepted axioms, and instead to adopt the identity of world historic figures, fully conscious of our link to the previous noble struggles to develop a more perfect, more human civilization. On our program today, we will be discussing this with three individuals who were instrumental in producing this documentary: Phil Rubenstein, who appears as one of the commentators and also served as an advisor, and LaRouche Youth Movement members Nick Walsh and Spencer Cross, who are among the principal movers behind this documentary. So Phil, Nick, and Spencer, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Hello. Thanks. Good to be here.
Now, Phil, let's start with you with an obvious question. Why is the year 1932 so important?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that are important in looking at this, because, you know, there's a certain sense of, well, you know, 1932, there was the nominating convention of the Democratic Party. We have one every 4 years. What's different? 1932, I think if we look back at it, was a decisive moment. The question was, would the United States capitulate to fascism? We already had fascism on the march through Europe. Mussolini had been in power for 9 years. And, of course, there was a clear battle in Germany, which it was reaching a decisive point. In fact, by the end of 1932, there was some question as to whether the Nazi Party could survive. At the end of that year, it looked like it might not survive. And there was a move by the ruling oligarchy in early 1932, early 33, through Montague Norma, the Bank of England, through Harriman Brothers, and, of course, the grandfather of our present president, to move into that situation and to prop up by financing Schroeder's Bank was involved and so forth, financing the Nazi Party in a last-ditch effort. And that effort was going on almost contemporaneous with the nomination of Franklin Roosevelt at the 1932 convention a little earlier. In fact, during the convention, that was right after the high point of the Nazi Party vote. They fell off later that year, causing a crisis. So the fact of the matter is, the issue was, would the United States be a bulwark against fascism and a revival of the economies of the globe in a positive sense? Had Roosevelt not been nominated, and of course the fascism would have likely succeeded, including in the United States.
And there was a fight at the convention to determine whether or not Roosevelt could be stopped.
Right, exactly. So what you had at this convention, I mean, Roosevelt came in well ahead in the delegate votes. However, at that time, you needed two-thirds of a vote to succeed. And out of what was then largely the Morgan interests, as we've documented in this DVD and in other places, the Morgan interests under John Raskob, their control of people like Al Smith and others, their view was that they were going to stop the Roosevelt nomination. And they knew who Roosevelt was. Contrary to popular opinion, this was not a matter of Roosevelt later on pragmatically adapting to the conditions. Roosevelt had demonstrated as the governor of New York that he represented an American system policy, a policy based on the general welfare, a policy based on infrastructure development, and proper government regulation of things like the utilities, electric industry, social security projects similar to Social Security. So they knew who Roosevelt was, and they were determined to stop him. Therefore, the fight at the 1932 convention, the fight that carried over into the assassination attempt, the coup attempt against Roosevelt later on, this was a crucial determining moment in history. That Roosevelt was ultimately nominated, that he carried this into his presidency, elected to four terms, serving three terms and a fraction, that is what made the difference. Had Roosevelt not been nominated, fascism, Hitler, would likely have succeeded, and world history would have been totally different. The only other thing I would point to briefly is that, of course, this occurs, as the DVD goes through, approximately 40 years after Bismarck is removed as the Chancellor of Germany.
Well, Phil, I wanted to pose a second question to you, which is that the documentary covers the period actually from 1861 to 1932. Mm-hmm. So what is the common thread which linked those two decisive moments?
Well, I think the common thread is, what was the Civil War and what was Lincoln? This was a British effort to destroy the United States, as was understood by people like Lincoln and the circle around him. The United States, contrary to popular belief, we fought the American Revolution against the British. We fought the War of 1812 against the British when we were in a very weakened condition, and the British were the preeminent force in the world. We succeeded under the leadership of people like Henry Clay and Madison and so forth. The last effort to destroy the United States by brute force was the Civil War. And it failed. It failed under the leadership of Lincoln. And this determined the rise of the American system as a potentially hegemonic force in the world, as a political force of a commonality of purpose and principle amongst nations, a Westphalian world. And that was something that was building in Germany, in Russia, in China, in the latter part of the 19th century. The British determined to capture the United States, let's say internally, to take it over from the inside, epistemologically. And it did that by a series of attacks on the leadership of the United States and those who were working with us globally, people like Mendeleev and Witte, but most especially Bismarck in Germany. And this opened up the door to the activity that led to World War I under Prince Edward Albert, King Edward VII. So with the fall of Bismarck in 1890, you can say that the counter operations to the rise of the American system went full tilt. And this ultimately led to World War I. This was key to being able to set up Russia versus Germany and so on. Nations which had begun to work together in this American system, Westphalian world. And so you had the 40-year period from 1890, under Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, who brought the Confederacy into the White House, the KKK, the destruction of the American system, the introduction of the Federal Reserve, a whole array of things, not any one thing, and the capturing of the United States under this insane free trade, anti-general welfare policy, which led to the Depression.
And so in 1932, you had the reemergence under FDR of the American system.
Exactly.
Now, you're listening to Phil Rubenstein on The LaRouche Show. I'm going to turn now to Nick Walsh, who was one of the people who played a leading role in putting this DVD, this documentary, together. Again, 1932 is available. It's up on the LaRouche Pack website. And, Nick, this will be out in a DVD form soon, won't it?
Yeah, pretty soon. It'll be, well, we'll have something that people can make DVDs with within a couple days. And then we'll have a mass distribution item within, 2 to 3 weeks.
All right, well, let me ask you a question that gets it to me, what's one of the most stunning aspects of this, which is that we did cover the period that Phil was just describing in the DVD from 1861 to 1932 as a unity of effect. How difficult was it? I mean, both in terms of the learning process of the events and then putting it into some kind of clear, coherent historic context. It seems to me that was one of the most important things you had to do in preparing this.
Yeah, for me, the most exciting research was on the 1890 to 1914 period, because if you told an average American that we're going to sit you down and teach you about European and Asian history between 1890 and 1914, that's not exactly the most exciting thing for them to hear. But through researching this and situating it in between the bookends of Lincoln preceding that period and FDR, so, you know, following that period of 1890 to 1914, in other words, the ouster of Bismarck in Germany, like Phil was saying, the reversal of the American system by the British, the assassination of McKinley, our president, and the replacement of him with Teddy Roosevelt, the whole series of actions by King Edward VII to launch World War I, and then the continuation of that into the 1920s, that's all essential to really understand the kind of chaos and the kind of world that Franklin Roosevelt was saving us from, which was a world of complete potential destruction of all of civilization. And so it was very fun to connect Lincoln into FDR very clearly through this arc, which was an arc that was out to destroy what Lincoln had done. And this is really the way to understand, I think, how Roosevelt then came in. What when we say Roosevelt was in the tradition of Lincoln, or knew Lincoln, or was acting on Lincoln's policies, he was doing it specifically in a very specific sense, knowing that this arc of history, this arc of destruction by the British had gone on in the wake of the successes from our victory in the Civil War.
We'll take any email questions from our listeners. You can send them to us at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio, R-A-D-I-O, at LaRouche Pub, LaRouchePub.com. Now, Nick, I know you had a chance to work quite closely with Lyndon LaRouche on this project. He wrote maybe, I think, 3 or 4 documents on history during this period. How was it that what was the effect of this kind of collaboration in putting it together?
Well, the way that LaRouche allows this kind of history, and he essentially conceived the video. It's his conception in terms of pinpointing that we're going into a convention now. We're approaching a summer nominating convention. The way the election was carried out over the past year, the way that Hillary Clinton was attacked, the type of leadership that you have, the type of right-wing leadership in the Democratic Party today that you have, is strikingly similar to the kind of things that were done in 32 against Roosevelt. But LaRouche said, well, okay, how do you address it? Look at this interval from 1890 to 1932 and understand that and start to put together that history. And what he really has emphasized, which is key to his understanding and of history, and really anyone's understanding to really get it, is that history is driven by individuals, and that it's the individual personalities, for good or for evil, that actually determine our world today. And so I think when we approached it from that standpoint of looking at the fact that mankind is not an animal, human beings are not beasts, and human beings have an insight and a social process governed by ideas and governed by principles and axioms that people believe in. You have movements that are organized around those ideas. So history is a battle of ideas, and it's driven by individual personalities that willfully take leadership, either for good or evil. And so you have Abraham Lincoln saves the Union, and he's in a war against the British, which is led by Lord Palmerston at that time. And King Edward VII is the successor to Lord Palmerston, launches a war to reverse the successes of the American system after the Civil War. Otto von Bismarck is someone who had picked up on the American system and is individually an obstacle to World War I being started, the Chancellor of Germany, Bismarck. And as long as Bismarck personally is in the chancellorship, World War I will not start because of the nature of his knowledge and insight into how to prevent war. So Edward ousts Bismarck and so on. And you have these events are all driven not by forces and whatnot, but by individual actions. And then you come to that's the drama of Franklin Roosevelt is he individually decides to save the world. He individually intervenes. And you see with his death the fact that when he dies, the British destruction of civilization resumes and advances again with his absence. And so it's our role today, it's the individual person today, not someone that's been granted some special power or born into the right family or whatnot, but it's really the individual person that decides to know this history and takes responsibility for acting on it that actually can save the world and advance humanity. Or it's the lack of action of any individual that can cause humanity to be lost.
Well, let me bring Spencer in on this question, because Spencer was also working with you in putting this together, Nick, and one of the things, Spencer, that Lynn has been talking about is that while you cannot blame an individual for a tragedy, that is, it's a cultural problem, but an individual, as Nick was just saying, can intervene to prevent tragedy. To what extent, in preparing this, were you conscious of the discussion that Lyndon LaRouche has initiated on tragedy to make this kind of a classical tragic work of or a work of tragic classical art as opposed to merely a documentary?
Well, my idea of it developed through the development of the project, but even in one of Mr. LaRouche's interviews in the film, he makes the point regarding Abraham Lincoln that Lincoln was unique in being a fully conscious individual actor in history, where, you know, Lincoln had a view that he was in a sense, a successor to Henry Clay and the founders of the American Revolution. And in some of the speeches we use in the film, he's very open about that. He's very open about how the sanctity of the Union and how the Southern secession wasn't even a real honest secession, that it had no legal merit. And you see the same thing with Franklin Roosevelt, where it's not contrary to the popular view in textbooks and, you know, History Channel documentaries and such, is the view is that he's some reactionary, just sort of came into office, didn't know what he was doing, scrambled some policies together to try and throw out a problem, but that you see it in his early governorship with his policies intended to alleviate the effects of the Depression, things like this, and his connection early on, which we document in the film, his view of the revolution, his view of Alexander Hamilton, his family's roots in the founding of the nation, that he came into the fight fully conscious of what he was up against and acted in kind.
We're starting to get some email questions in, which we'll get to in a moment. And if you have questions for our panel, please send them radio@larouchepub.com. If we don't get to your questions on the air today, one of the panelists will send a response. Now, Phil, I want to go back to this question of the individual, and you raised the point that once FDR prevailed at the convention, and that was not so clear that that would happen. It was largely by force of his individual commitment that he overwhelmed the Morgan operation. But we have in the documentary the story of the assassination attempt and the coup attempt. Was this the Morgans also?
This is completely the Morgans. And I mean, we have the case of Smedley Butler in particular, who had been organized by the Liberty League and so forth. And this was a grouping of financiers, Wall Street, the same grouping, Raskob, Morgan, and a number of people out of Morgan Guarantee who went to Smedley Butler, offered him the funds to organize effectively a rebellion of veterans and so forth against Roosevelt. And he testified to this effect. So this, I mean, and remember, when we say Morgan interests, this was General Motors, it was DuPont, but J.P. Morgan and the Morgan interests came directly out of London in the late 19th century. And this was the leading financial grouping or institution in the United States operating from a London-based perspective of taking down U.S. industrial capability, taking down the U.S., the American system, instituting the central banking system that was at least partly reflected in the Federal Reserve. So what you have is a very clear idea that FDR represents the American system. And so the right-wing elements, largely reflected publicly in this Liberty League, later on the America First lobby, these were somewhat, sometimes decent people would get confused into this. But the large factor of policy and the interests behind it are directly traceable to the very same people, in the case of Raskob, the Morgan interests themselves directly, who were deployed against Roosevelt at the 1932 convention. And I think it's useful to recognize that part of the reason Lyndon LaRouche wanted this done was this election year, this upcoming convention, which many people think is a closed deal but is not, is a decisive moment in history, as 1932 was, where we're going to answer the question of reviving the American system as LaRouche has defined it, and as in some ways Hillary Clinton responded to, or are we going to end up going in an entirely different direction with a total breakdown of the system well beyond anything we saw in the Depression? So indeed, these people were deployed to destroy Roosevelt every step of the way. And in fact, without going into a long story, I would add that when Roosevelt knew World War II was on the horizon, and he began to prepare for this through the Depression. When the war broke out, he was immediately involved in a direct clash with Winston Churchill, of course representing the British Empire, as to how to run that war, whether that war was going to be run to liberate the colonial world, end empire, or in effect be a war to save the British Empire, which was why Churchill sided with the United States, thinking that indeed to be a junior partner to Hitler was not a particularly good idea. So that clash continued through the Depression, past the efforts to overthrow Roosevelt, to Churchill's effort to run the war.
Well, you've made the point, as have Nick and Spencer, that this question of why study history, that we see repeatedly these kinds of issues come up. We have an email from Robert Hill from California. I'm having little problems with my computer here right now. But what he asks about is he compares the possibility of Cheney launching a war between now and November to the guns of August. And I wonder if you'd care to comment on that, Phil, the possibility that to protect the British Empire and defeat this potential Franklin Roosevelt reflex, that London would use their tool, their guided missile, Dick Cheney, to launch a war at this point.
Well, I think this is something, I know that Lyndon LaRouche has mentioned this over the last few days, even to note the fact that there's been a lot of talk about negotiating with Iran, coming from people globally, coming from people in the State Department even, and then they'll say in the next breath, after they say, well, we're willing to negotiate a suspension of the uranium enrichment, and then they say, but, it has to be immediately suspended. And Lynn's concern is that they'll start a negotiation in order to end it, in order to say, well, since Iran didn't adhere, do anything positive, now we know we have to go to war. And I think absolutely that Cheney and others that we see are prepared to put some combination together between the United States and Israel that would launch a British-dominated war against Iran. See, remember, it was Tony Blair and people like John Scarlett, the head of British intelligence, who sexed up the reports at the fall of 2002 that nailed shut the war that Cheney ultimately launched. We're seeing the same thing now. This is a British-controlled flight into war and into some form of rule by decree, some form of fascist top-down rule under this kind of chaotic outbreak of war. It may not take in every case the same form. But indeed, this is a very, very serious reality that it would be meant to implement the kind of top-down control that they want. I think the Guns of August, yes. This is also something, I think one of the things in this is people don't realize how much processes can be set into motion that run out of control, that even if you wanted to stop it, you couldn't stop it. So that's what people who are trying to accommodate to what Cheney and company are up to, what the British are up to, by playing within the rules of their game, can find themselves trapped. And I think we see this very much in the effort of people of people in the Democratic Party to get tough on Iran as part of their anti-war posture in Iraq. But this won't work. You're going to be trapped into war. And this may be the last desperate thing that's done. Because the other thing I would say to look at this, look at the last few days, the upset by people like Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, which LaRouche has identified, Barroso, the Secretary General of the European Union, at the reference by people like Giulio Tremonti to the idea of controlling speculation, a new Bretton Woods, and of course Tremonti is a figure who has openly identified himself with LaRouche on this issue of the need for a new financial system from the ground up. So he comes under attack. I think what we have to see is that there will be a desperation by the British imperial forces using people like Cheney to destroy any tendency to break out of this death spiral of the present financial system. So it's real, and I think on the other side we see typified by somebody like Tremonti listening to Lynn, or what seems to be a dialogue between LaRouche and many of the people in Russia and China over how to break the back of this drive for war and fascism coming out of the British interests and their allies, their Tory, we might say, allies in the United States.
Well, Nick, in the work that you did to put this together, what surprised you the most in looking at this period in history? What was it that was the more interesting kind of discoveries you made?
Well, really that just how significant the actions of one person actually is in determining 100-year arcs of history. And it's really, like I said earlier, that's either for good or for evil, in either way. You can especially capture it in the good, because when individuals act for the good, there's a whole potential there that is that is unfolded in the universe. The universe responds happily to people like Abraham Lincoln's leadership, because the intention of nature is to develop under mankind's dominion. And that's what Lincoln represented. But, it's not to say Lincoln was just, obviously, just a Superman figure, just imposing development in the world. But his personal leadership and his networks and his organizing of the army, of the Union Army, his organizing of his own cabinet, which was really a goofy cabinet, his organizing of the American population to stick with the War of Union. This is why we still have a union today. Without Lincoln individually, we wouldn't have a country. At that point, we would have ceased to exist. And it's that type of leadership. I mean, his entire cabinet, for example, was advising that we shouldn't even fight when the South seceded. The majority of his cabinet was saying, don't fight the war. And they'll come back. One of the guys was saying, oh, they'll come back into the Union within a couple of years. So people, this history is lost. People just assume that the Civil War was inevitable and we, of course, we were going to fight. No. I mean, there was huge movements saying, don't fight at all. Just let the South peacefully secede and we'll become two different countries. Or they'll come back later. And this type of recognition of that today is something that we need to revive. And it can be revived, I think, through this conception of drama. Because you see in historical drama how ideas work within a social process as driven by individual minds, and how they're picked up by the next generation and the next generation, and how individuals die, but their ideas live through the succeeding generations that care about those ideas. And that's what we're a part of now. We are not a generation of Americans disconnected from this rich history of the founding of the greatest nation, the most powerful, beautiful nation in the history of the world. Not something that that is an island, but something that is beautiful because it comes out of the most beautiful history, the most beautiful individuals of Europe, the most beautiful ideas in the individuals of Greece. But that's what the United States is, and Lincoln knew that. Otto von Bismarck knew that as a German leader. FDR definitely knew it.
Well, Spencer, as someone who, before you came into work on this, you were organizing up in the Northwest in Seattle, to what extent do you think there's obviously a fight that has to go on to invoke in people this notion? You have on the one hand the irony of the 4th of July, everyone saluting flags and red, white, and blue and talking about the Declaration of Independence. On the other hand, you have people who seem to be acting without any real understanding of the fact that we're about to lose that legacy. So how do you see the DVD on this 1932 project fitting in with an overall process of organizing to actually change the way people think?
Well, one way I think our film communicates a specific aspect of that question is that most Americans don't really know the history of our own nation at this point. There's been such a cultural collapse over the last, especially 30 years and more, where we, in schools or what have you, we just don't get a real American education. And in this film, I think we go through the key elements of the founding of the nation, as we've all been going through in this discussion today, what Lincoln did to industrialize and what Franklin Roosevelt did to reshape that and develop upon that process. But one way we do it, I think we developed this concept in juxtaposition, is the role of the British. And from a major theme among a lot of the responses we've received on this video thus far are that people didn't know that the British were running all of these operations. They didn't know that, you know, McKinley was a pro-development president who was proposing rail links for all the American countries from Alaska to the tip of, you know, Argentina and Chile. That he was proposing these types of projects for collaboration among the Western Hemisphere. And they didn't know that Teddy Roosevelt was a complete British dupe who's writing these very sappy, sentimental letters to King Edward VII about union of the Anglo-American races. And upon McKinley's death, Teddy Roosevelt went into the South American nations as a debt collector for these international banks. And in an attempt to rip up the last vestiges of the Monroe Doctrine, which McKinley had helped to develop and build upon. So I think there's been a real great response to that, as far as all throughout what we go through in the video of the relationship of Britain and the United States, that these British agents and all the harm that's been done to the nation has primarily a result of this British theme, and there's a gut-wrenching quality to it, so that at the end, I think, at the end of the film, when we go through the death of Franklin Roosevelt and what that legacy, what that change represents for today, how that change, that death of FDR and the ending of his legacy lasts until the present day, you see it. At that point, I think you completely see it, that the British, over and over, it's the same tricks. It's just like watching a Shakespeare film series, like the, as LaRouche has pointed out recently with this latest paper about the Shakespeare's English history plays, where if you were to sit and watch all the history plays or read them, you see the same thing, the same tricks, the same British tricks over and over again.
Well, it seems that part of the trick is also to distort the nature of history. Phil, I want you to comment on the way in which so many Americans who are interested in history are getting a history which essentially says the United States was really an empire set up by rich white merchants, and it was a continuation of English common law, and you know, this seems to be the Howard Zinn school, but This is a pretty serious problem, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. I think that in some ways you want to try to cut through a lot of thicket of fraud and lies. The United States was built on free trade and taxation without representation and so on and so forth. Some of these things were issues, but as I've often pointed out, if you read the Declaration of Independence and you ask where does taxation without representation come, it's something like 18th on the list of grievances. And the leading elements of the list of grievances is the lack of concern for the general welfare, the lack of the ability giving people the ability to act politically to guarantee the well-being of the citizenry. That's points 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 10. Now, of course, one of the leading examples of this is this idea that John Locke, and of course this gets to the guts of the issue of what is British imperialism. It's liberalism. It's empiricism. It's the idea that the human mind cannot discern principle in the universe, that we're not attuned to the discovery of the fundamental directing principles of the universe, and therefore concerted social human action is to be denigrated, which is what government is, at its best at least. So what do you have from John Locke? Life, liberty, and property. Now, most people are taught that the U.S. Constitution is based in John Locke. Yet, the explicit difference in the U.S. Constitution, let's say, from the Confederate States, or the Constitution of the Carolinas, which Locke wrote, is life, liberty, and property versus life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, that idea of the pursuit of happiness is explicitly the concept of Leibniz, felicity, happiness, which is based in wisdom and the perfection of human knowledge. So the U.S. Constitution, as a principle, is based in opposition to John Locke, and empiricism and British social contract liberalism. That's real history. Those are the truths.
In the documentary, there are several examples. Nick, I think you have quotes from Henry Carey explicitly identifying that this is not the America was created against the British system. But this is pretty much written out of history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, are you asking me or Phil?
Yeah, I'm asking you, Nick.
Yeah, it's written out of history by the British. They tend to control these things, just as they did. I mean, you see it with FDR's period too. You see that, five out of six newspapers were run by the British. And when we talk about Wall Street, we're talking about the British. Because the Wall Street Morgan, who ran Wall Street, he was a British bank. It was founded in London, and then it was transported to the U.S. as an extension of British power in the United States economy. And it's the same today. The textbooks of our country, the history books, are controlled by British publishing houses, British money, Wall Street money. And this is an empire. It's the same empire. It's not the empire of gunboats and cannons and you know invading American shores with British, you know, redcoats, but it's the British system of globalization. And as we touch on this and start to introduce the character of H.G. Wells, who was the director of intelligence for the British during World War I. He wasn't a writer. This guy was, not merely a writer, but he was really a leading operative for brainwashing and mental control of the subjects of the growing British Empire of the 20th century. And their main idea was mind control, to really subvert truth, to promote lies, to promote confusion, mysticism, magic, Satanism, and then economic policies that go along with that lead to poverty, war, and just all-out bad things for the world. And you have we had leaders in the later after FDR that challenged these problems, and this is the legacy that Lyndon LaRouche is in today. Is he is the guy that really is fighting. And the great thing, one more thing you'd asked me earlier about this sense of getting from the research, what did we discover? I know I came with a really glaring sense, a really obvious sense of how the real American system patriots are not afraid of this British Empire. That we're not afraid of the British. We take them on. And our mission is to destroy the British Empire. They're out to destroy us. Well, we're out to destroy them. And you see that with Roosevelt very clearly, and you see that today with Lyndon LaRouche. That's something that more American people need to become fond of, is Lyndon LaRouche's passion for getting rid of oligarchy.
Well, I think one of the ways to get that is that people should go on to the LaRouche PAC website, because what we're talking about is a new documentary that was just released this week to coincide with July 4th. It's called 1932. I guess the subhead is Speak Not of Parties, but of Universal Principles. Now, one of the other questions I have for anyone on the panel, we have about 18 minutes left to go on the program, and to get into one of the specific points, which, again, I think few people know anything about, is the post-Civil War mobilization globally, the spread of the American system, which is done very nicely with a map showing arrows going all over the world, and the period from 1876 forward with Europe, Japan. Why don't one of you just give a summary of what happened, which is what triggered the British decision that they had no choice but to launch World War I. Spencer, you want to pick it up?
Well, sure. I'll start at least. I think what happened is the nations of the world finally got what they had wanted, which is that the American victory over the British in the American Revolution signaled to the world that things had changed, that a nation could found itself on natural law, on the idea that mankind is unique from animals, and that we have sacred rights as human beings, that we have the right to develop our minds, the right to use our lives to create better conditions for our children and grandchildren. And that idea excited the world. And after Lincoln finally defeated the British system militarily, then we had the ability to spread that system around the globe. And this happened in Japan. This happened in Germany with Bismarck. This happened in China. A little bit later, this happened in South America. And what I think the kernel of it was that these nations finally, after having seen the victory in the American Revolution, finally got the development they knew was natural to man.
And it was pretty amazing, because Lincoln was assassinated 5 days after the end of the Civil War by the British agents. I mean, John Wilkes Booth was a trained agent of the Knights of the Golden Circle and these different British agents out of Canada. And the principal agents who had assassinated Lincoln, who had been responsible for the conspiracy, fled to safety in Britain and were never captured, although the federal government included them in the list of indicted persons. But the intention was to sow chaos in the United States, to have the government of the United States dissolve with this kind of an atrocity, and especially at the end of a civil war. I mean, if you look at most civil wars that have occurred in countries in history, countries don't recover from civil wars for decades. Maybe they never do. There's many countries today that still haven't recovered from previous civil wars. Whereas our country, under the leadership of some of Lincoln's collaborators like Henry Carey, became the most powerful economy on the planet within a very short period of time of this horrible civil war. I mean, it's only possible because of the power of our ideas and because of the power of the principles that the civil war was fought over.
And that, of course, created a profound reaction from the British, specifically Edward Albert. Phil, I'd like you to comment on that, because one of the most striking aspects of the documentary to me was your description of Queen Victoria as the Queen Termite, and that the breeding of a termite mound of characters, right, chief among whom was Prince Edward Albert. Clearly, he saw this, what Nick just described, as the emergence of the post-Civil War Lincoln economic policy. Even though they tried to sabotage it every way they could, nevertheless, after 1876, it had established a new principle of national development. So why was this such a threat to the British? Why couldn't they have just joined it?
Well, I think Edward Albert represents an oligarchical outlook. I mean, you could say, although this might be even worse, that he was the lead drone, even though it was his mother, in this production of this oligarchical web throughout Europe. And the idea was, this is going to control, this is going to stay in power. In a sense, it's almost like a species distinction, because the people like Edward Albert believe, as Zeus did to Prometheus, that the average human individual, the average man, the invisible man, the forgotten man, as Roosevelt referred to them in different occasions, has no right to develop the powers of their mind and demand an increasing development of the human species. So Zeus or Edward Albert says, no, we're going to control this. And I think the thing that they really saw, because we're doing the same thing today, the Eurasian land bridge, is this wasn't just a bunch of nations picking up an idea. They believed that now a new principle could be applied to their relations amongst nations. That was the basis for Bismarck to say, there's no reason for us to have conflict with Russia. In fact, Russia's development as a land-based power, and there's, I mean, more to reference in this in terms of land-based versus sea-based power, but as a land-based power, if Russia developed, Germany would have a great link to all of Asia, to China, one of the other great civilization, as Leibniz foresaw it 300 years before. And so this Westphalian order, an order where each nation saw the other's development as to their advantage, and then concretized in the development of rail systems that allowed transportation to bring industrial development, and the fact that almost every inch of the way as you cross the continent, you were adding value to production. You were adding scientific knowledge, industrial technological development. These nations, in the form of people like Mendeleev, Witte, Bismarck, Sun Yat-sen, and so forth, people like Pellegrino in Argentina, they recognized that they were on the verge of a whole new era of human development based on a new principle applied through the victory of the American system, which was explicitly a Westphalian system. One of the great mentors of Lincoln was John Quincy Adams, the author of the Monroe Doctrine, which was based on the Westphalian conception of the common development of nations outside of the oligarchical web. Edward Albert knew that this was the end of his species. I mean, he, as a human being, he could have added to it. He could have been part of it. But he saw this as an attack, essentially a new evolutionary development beyond the species that he represented, or this termite mound that he wanted to live in. And so he took upon himself to interject the oligarchical relations, the fact that indeed his mother had as offspring nephews and nieces much of the oligarchy of Europe, which gave him a position to manipulate people like Kaiser Wilhelm, Tsar Nicholas, and to break down the very development that would supersede their existence. And once he was able to do that with the reigning oligarchical system, he brought on World War I, which of course demoralized much of Europe for decades beyond that. The existing optimism in the United States was because of Roosevelt. So I think this is a real battle of principle. I mean, the one thing I would add, not to go on too long here, but the one thing I would add is that what Lynn has emphasized, and I think he's emphasizing in his whole discussions up to the very day in the work in the basement, is that the human species is defined by its ability to discover universal principles. The ordering principles of the physical and the social universe, and that this is communicable to other human beings. The British system says that doesn't occur. That can't occur. Most human beings are incapable of that kind of action, and indeed that kind of knowledge is unavailable. Universal principle does not exist as real knowledge. It's all it is is a series of experiences that you might put a statistical label on. So the battle between the American system and the British system is a battle between two views of the human species. A developmental view, a view that's rooted in the idea of the unboundedness of human development, based on that knowledge, versus the fixity of empire in which most of the human species is reduced to enslavement.
Well, this is we've been listening to a discussion of the new DVD, 1932. We still have about 8 or 9 minutes left, and I want to come back to a couple of other questions, but I want to remind our listeners of one other upcoming development or upcoming event, which will be the next international webcast, worldwide webcast of Lyndon LaRouche, which will be Tuesday, July 22nd. And that will be at 1 p.m. Eastern Time in Washington, D.C. It will be live on the LaRouche Pack website. That's Tuesday, July 22nd at 1 p.m. And this is almost a year after his very famous now webcast of July 25th, 2007, during which he said the financial system has gone, it's collapsed. And, of course, since then we've seen a number of efforts to resurrect the corpse of the financial system, mostly just through pumping money in, low interest rates, trying to keep the toxic waste flowing, and it doesn't work. So Lyndon LaRouche will put forward his alternative as well as his explanation as to what happened. He's been the only economist who's had accurate forecasting over the last 40 years, so don't miss it. July 22nd, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the LaRouchePack.com website. Now, Nick and Spencer, have either of you gotten much feedback yet from people who have seen the DVD? Do you have much of a sense of how it's going in terms of the initial distribution?
Yeah, people like it. We've gotten a lot of responses from people around the country, different offices. I think, well, for example, one thing that struck a number of people was this Henry Wallace speech. The fact that Henry Wallace, you know, that Franklin Roosevelt had such a capable vice president. I mean, such a serious guy. And that the fight against the British Empire was such an explicit thing for Roosevelt's administration of the 1940s, that this in the 20th century, this fight against the British, our country's war against the British Empire to develop other nation states and to get rid of empire systems like what's based in London today, that was a living fight in the 20th century. This wasn't something that you find in the 19th century and then disappears. But Wallace, as you can see in this movie that we made, you can see, you know, this speech, this clip of it that we have, and people can access the whole thing. You know, But you see, he was giving television broadcasts, going through these ideas with people, and talking about the revolutionary nature of the American system. And,
hey, Nick, yeah. where were the quotes from that the last section with the animation of Churchill, Wallace, and Roosevelt?
Yeah, that's mostly from Elliot Roosevelt's book, As He Saw It. And I'll let just generally, well, I mean, specifically also a section of that was from another short thing that a journalist had written who had also attended some of these discussions. So it was a combination of two of those things. It's all based on real dialogue, real material. And the thing generally is what we're going to be putting together is a research archive of all of the pictures, all of the books, all of the videos that we compiled for the production of this, because it's a pretty good mass of material. A lot of it is stuff that really isn't looked at anymore and should be. And so we're going to be putting together kind of, in a sense, a bibliography attached to the link on the website where you watch the video. And people will be able to do further research, because that's really obviously needed, is people need to take some of these shorter clips and shorter anecdotes of some characters in this long arc of history that we develop and start to really get to know these people and start to revive this sense of history.
Well, I think the other thing that comes through is this question of the role of the individual and the individual personality. Spencer, did this have a particular effect on you, or were you already completely familiar with all these characters?
Oh, no. Well, two things. One is that we had a sneak preview for some of our associates out here of one of the near-to-final editions, and there's a well-read speech by William McKinley on the role of free trade in the middle of the movie,
right,
which garnered a lot of applause and cheering and whooping about this William McKinley speech. And I think we were sort of laughing that if we can get 18 to 25-year-olds excited about one of the most obscure U.S. presidents, then we did something all right. But the other thing is that working on the epilogue section, the part around Franklin Roosevelt's death and how that affects, how that led into the present day, is one of the, I think, the most gripping and also subjective aspects of the parts of the film, where we hope that at this point the audience is going to begin to reflect on how the only real way to look at any of these processes is exactly how LaRouche has, I think, ironically defined it, that from the ouster of Bismarck is what's affecting everything we see today. And the role of this individual, as Nick and others on this call have developed this idea, that the role of the individual in shaping everything, and especially in the case of Franklin Roosevelt, where once the physical person goes, and then the British have spent the last 50 years trying to eliminate that legacy and having difficulty doing it. But relative to the current political crisis that we've all been talking about, that we hope to challenge people that their actions in the coming period is completely what's going to determine this whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Phil, we have about 2 minutes left, and I know you and I have talked on occasion of the subject of the lives of both Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt as such lives that could be the subject of classical tragedy. From working on this and seeing this, would you say this is a good start in putting together the actual story of the tragedy of the nation in losing sight of what the two of them represented?
No, I think exactly. The fact that these two types of people and the kind of person that Lynn represents today as the inheritor and expander of this tradition, that American citizens could be so wrapped up in the immediate, in entertainment, in their own sense perception, and that becomes truth to them, or the truth is not discoverable, is the great tragedy of the last 40 years. I think what you see with this idea that Nick and you and Spencer have been getting at of the individual is the human individual is by nature transcendent. That is, that the human individual is capable of being outside and above all of the immediate circumstances that he or she lives in, because the human individual is capable of looking at the arc of history and discerning principle in the human relationship to nature and society. And so the human individual, finite and mortal though he or she may be, has the capability of transcending those limitations, of acting to subsume everything that has gone before him or her, and to bring other human beings into that realm of transcendent principle, of creating a universe that extends into the future for other human beings.
And Phil, we're going to have to end with that. I'd like to thank Phil and Nick and Spencer for joining us. You can go on the website. We've been talking about the new documentary, 1932. It will be available as a DVD soon. Check on the website for information on that. And until next week, you've been listening to the LaRouche Show every week, Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern. Goodbye.